Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of You Make Me Sick. Very special episode today. We actually have Dr. Davidson Hamer. He is a professor of global health and medicine at the Boston University School of Public Health and Cobanian and Abyssinian School of Medicine. He is also an adjunct professor of nutrition at Tufts University Friedman School of Nutrition Science and Policy here in Boston, Massachusetts. He is a board-certified specialist in infectious diseases, in particular on tropical infectious diseases. He has extensive field experience in neonatal and child survival research, maternal and neonatal health, with focuses on studies in micronutrient interventions, as well as diseases such as malaria, different pneumonias, and diarrheal diseases. Dr. Hamer is also the surveillance lead of the GeoSentinel Surveillance Network, which is a global network of 70 different sites in 31 countries where they conduct surveillance of emerging infectious diseases using returning travelers, immigrants, and refugees as sentinels for infections. Today, he has joined us to discuss a current H5N1 situation that has spread from avian fowl or birds in general just to a number of dairy herds here in the United States, and just kind of what we might have to look for or expect in the near future. So thank you very much for joining us and just taking the time. Today, so as I said, I was kind of hoping to talk about just the increase of the influenza A H5N1 strain. Specific strain, I think right now is 2.3.4.4B. And it's currently spreading just throughout the U.S. I think the last check there were like 69 different herds affected in 9 different states. And just what this might mean, the spread to humans. No, go right ahead.
No, thank you for having me. I've been happy to discuss this topic. It's exciting but concerning.
Yeah, I wanted to start just by, so most people have heard of influenza or the flu. A lot of people have had it in the past. It's often a reference that we're using just for any kind of respiratory illness, and we'll say, I have the flu. Influenza A in particular, I was just hoping you could explain what makes influenza A different from other influenza strains.
Well, it's actually, there are three major types of influenza, influenza A, B, and C. We never really hear very much about C, but both influenza A and B can cause widespread epidemics. In fact, they cause, you know, seasonal outbreaks of influenza, but if the viruses evolve enough, and we can talk more about that, they can then cause a pandemic. And so influenza A has caused more of the pandemics over time, but influenza B has also caused very large outbreaks.
So with all influenza A viruses, they're named based on kind of the receptors. So they have two receptors, hemagglutinin and neuraminidase. Can you explain to our audience essentially what these receptors do and why these are so important with viral spread?
Yes. So hemagglutinin is a glycoprotein that you find on the surface of virus, and it helps with the attachment of virus to host cells. And it also helps with the release of viral RNA into the cell. So it basically helps with sort of binding and then sort of the initial phase of attack of human cells, whereas neuraminidase is it's an enzyme that removes sialic acid from sialic acid glycoproteins and basically helps with the release of new virions from its affected cells. And so the H and N, as we've heard a lot, there are several different types of H, I think mostly H1 through 3, but for the N, there are many different types of neuraminidase, and viruses are named based on, especially influenza A, on the number of sort of a new nomenclature that's based on the neuraminidase and hemagglutinin antigens. And actually, one additional comment, that is that these are also very important targets for host immunity to protect us against disease.
So with regard to some of that right there, so with viruses and their ability to kind of mutate, and I think we'll kind of get into why this might be so important, there are a couple of different terms in how they mutate. One is called antigenic drift, and the other is antigenic shift. And they kind of facilitate this process called genetic reassortment. Are you able to kind of describe or kind of explain just how the antigenic drift may differ from shift and what this means with regard to viruses being able to actually kind of mutate to infect different hosts?
Yes. I mean, antigenic drift is basically sort of small sort of changes in the hemagglutinin and neuraminidase that lead to a different virus, but not so different that our immune system doesn't have some recognition of it. So they can lead to new infections, but there may be some cross immunity from prior episodes or from vaccination. In contrast, antigenic shift, there's a major reassortment. There's sort of often a mixing of the hemagglutinin and neuraminidase genes. And this can be within a species, sort of mixing within a bird, but it also can be across species. And classically, it's been birds, pigs, and humans, which there's a mix. And if a completely new virus comes up that has a new hemagglutinin and or neuraminidase, then we don't have any immunity to that. And that can lead to a pandemic. And that's pretty much what happened in 2009 with they call it variant H1N1 influenza A global pandemic.
So kind of on that same note, when you're talking about how it mutates between different species, and like you said, it was previously just known essentially between fowl and pigs and humans. I kind of want to mention there was a recent preprint study, and I'll preface this by letting our listeners know that preprint studies are essentially, they're studies that have been submitted for review, peer review, and then if they pass that kind of that mark, then they'll eventually be placed in a journal and considered to be credible. So it is a preprint study, has not been peer reviewed, so we kind of take it with a grain of salt. But it was a recent study that was out of the University of Copenhagen in Denmark and then St. Jude's Children's Hospital in Memphis, Tennessee. And they've actually been analyzing tissue samples from bovine, so cow respiratory tract, brain, and their mammary glands, just in an attempt to see if there's any kind of binding sites for avian flu. What they did find is that there were duck and human type influenza A receptors widely expressed in the mammary gland, so essentially the cow udder. And there were also chicken type influenza receptors chicken type influenza receptors in the cow respiratory tract as well. And there was low expression, I guess, of influenza A in the brain. So with the growing number of bovine herds that are testing positive, do you think that H5N1 has a greater chance of mutating to a strain that could be passed to humans because they do share some of the common influenza receptors?
Yes and no. I mean, I'm definitely concerned. I think I'm aware of this preprint. And I think it's important to note that the vast majority of well-done preprints are it's a step to get the information out faster, and they usually end up in publication, often in major journals, after the peer review process. But that process can take sometimes weeks to months, and so there's a delay in getting the information out. So the preprint strategy has been used a lot, especially in COVID, to try and get information out faster. In this case, it's complicated because there are different types of receptors. And that said, I mean, there are a variety of potential receptors in different parts of the human body. But so far for the H5N1, the really worrisome receptors in the respiratory tract are much more deep in the lung. Also in the eye, though, because one of the earlier cases had conjunctivitis and sort of a scleral infection. And so the location of the receptor is important, because if you have receptors in the upper airway and the virus can effectively infect those, you're going to start shedding a lot of virus when you get sick. You're going to be coughing and sneezing and breathing out virus, and therefore much more efficiently transmitting it to other people. Whereas if it just sinks down in the lower respiratory tract, and that has been the case with H5N1 that has been around, because this has been a problem for a decade or two, especially in China and certain parts of the world in poultry farms, especially home poultry farms. And, you know, it goes from the chicken to humans. There's one infection, but there's been no onward spread in humans. But if the virus adapts and becomes more readily transmissible, by changing the binding site a little bit, then we could be in real trouble. And this whole thing with the bovine, with the cows, is really very interesting, because it's not, And with the current, I'd say, zoonotic, you know, in animals, pandemic of H5N1, there are many different mammalian and avian species that have been infected. But it's been, to me, a big surprise that we found it in cows. And yet now we should, you know, talk more about what the real risk is to people at this point in time about that.
Do you think, so you had mentioned earlier that, you know, typically swine are a very good kind of mixing bowl for these viruses to actually spread and affect humans, with H1N1 being a swine virus. And that was kind of one of the last major pandemics that we saw in the U.S. And around the world for influenza. So with a lot of these dairy herds being in close proximity to, you know, farms that probably house pigs as well, do you see that being just another risk factor for this spreading from cows to pigs and then mutating within the pig to being spread to humans?
I do. I mean, I think it's interesting because until this, the recent, you know, last couple of months, I don't think many people were really concerned about cows as a mixing vessel for influenza. Definitely pigs, and that's been a concern for a while, with you know, sort of well-documented spread from of certain swine influenza strains from pigs to humans at, say, you know, county fairs and situations like that. But with cows, it's a big news story because we have lots of cows, you know, both in dairy and then cattle industry across the United States.
So with, you know, continuing kind of the recent findings with the H5N1 in the dairy herds, there was another recent preprint study, and this was out of the University of Pittsburgh and Emory University. And in that study, they reported finding H5N1 on equipment that was used in the process for milking dairy cows. Per their findings, they found that H5N1 remained infectious in unpasteurized milk that was on rubber liners as well as stainless steel for more than an hour. The study also recognized that particles that were dispensed when you begin to hook up cows, you manually milk cows and then you hook them to the machines, that some of those particles could easily be aerosolized or have droplets that may come in contact with dairy workers. And as of right now, there are no precautions set in place for dairy workers to use any kind of either respiratory or eye protection while they're in the process of milking cows. Now, there have only been two known positive H5N1 human cases right now that are related to dairy cows. But with this new information, does this also kind of, you know, raise red flags as far as the possibility of H5N1 being able to be spread, as you said before, either through the eye or through respiratory inhalation of droplets or small aerosolized particles?
Yeah, sorry, I just had a phone call, but I'm going to let it go. I think there's a couple implications. One is it live virus that's surviving on surfaces? And we did lots of early, you know, worrying about and cleaning a surface with SARS-CoV-2. And the question is, you know, can that serve as can an inanimate object serve as a vehicle to lead to spread to humans? Not clear yet. I think that said, I think we need to be thinking about the safety of dairy workers and anybody who's handling cattle, and then also veterinarians, anybody that's in contact with cows. And they, I think we need to be thinking, you know, OSHA and other organizations, the FDA, whoever, you know, is really responsible, USDA perhaps is responsible, needs to think about, you know, protective eyewear and gloves at least, and then, you know, potentially cleaning of surfaces to try and reduce potential risk of exposure. But again, we've only had two cases so far. I suspect that those people who are using their hands and handling things that came in contact with live virus and then rubbed their eyes, and that's how they became infected. So, and that was actually during SARS-CoV-2, that was a concern that we could sort of have spread by that route. I think ultimately we learned that most of it was respiratory, but that was a different virus because this one right now is not going human to human yet. Hopefully it will not.
So the USDA, you just brought up, like, who might be regulating this, they've actually kind of been following the scenario pretty closely, and they've been doing laboratory testing with regard to testing milk and beef samples taken from infected cattle herds. The process of pasteurization helps to eliminate live viruses and bacteria, and essentially keeps milk safe that's on the shelves. So do you feel that the process of pasteurization will continue to provide enough safety, even with the increase in the number of dairy herds that we're seeing being affected by this?
Yes. There's actually been several studies looking at this already, and the FDA is, has conducted some of these. I mean, they've been looking at sort of temperature. In fact, there's also a preprint that came out that I just saw on this, where they looked at, it was a letter to the New England Journal of Medicine, looking at pasteurization and at, you know, pasteurization temperatures, which are in the order of like 68 degrees Celsius. There's very good inactivation of virus, maybe not complete, but pretty close to complete. So I think that and then the studies the FDA have done suggest that pasteurization is killing off virus. And so there may be some dead virus particles there that can't infect people. What worries me is raw milk, because there are groups of people that, you know, believe in sort of the health benefits of consuming raw milk, and there may be live virus in raw milk. So that's one comment. And then if we could talk about beef too, because this is an interesting topic. There is a study that I came across, and what was this? It was the Department of Agriculture. So the Animal Plant Health Inspection.
Is this the one where they infected 300 grams of live virus? Or let's say they infected live virus into 300 grams of ground beef. Yeah. Sorry, go right ahead. Yeah.
No, this is pretty cool. I mean, so basically they sort of infected ground beef patties, you know, sort of 300 gram, big hamburgers, and then they cooked them. And they cooked them to basically a temperature 120 Fahrenheit, which would be about what you'd have with a pretty raw, I mean, not raw, rare hamburger, 145 medium, and then 160 well done. And they found that there was no virus present in the burgers that were cooked to the medium or well done temperatures. And then they, you know, it sounds like even rare, there was substantial inactivation of virus, but there still may have been some virus present in the rare hamburger. So it suggests as we go into summer and summer barbecues and so forth, for those, who cook hamburgers, you need to probably make sure it's at least medium well done, or think about becoming a vegetarian.
Yeah, right. So we touched on a little bit just about prior pandemics and how influenza has caused multiple pandemics in the past. The last kind of great pandemic that we saw prior to COVID was the Spanish flu in 1918. That was H1N1, I believe. And that pandemic essentially infected about a third of the world's population. It killed an estimated 30 to 50 million people. Granted, H5N1 is a different virus than H1N1. And thankfully, right now, it's very low, the threat of a pandemic, at least from what we're seeing right now. But do you ever envision a scenario where H5N1 could mutate to get to a point that could cause another worldwide pandemic?
I'm concerned that this could happen. We now know that H5N1 is very widespread in many different domestic and wild bird populations, various mammalian populations. Now we're finding it in cows. So I think it's just a matter of time before it undergoes maybe reassortment with a pig or a bird virus that allows it to pick up the right genes to attach better to human upper respiratory tract epithelia and lead to a transmission. I think the follow-up to this, though, is this is a disease for which we already have some antivirals, so neuraminidase inhibitors that we use for seasonal influenza should appear to have activity against H5N1. And then vaccines, we know how to develop a vaccine and target it to the most common hemagglutinin and neuraminidase that is circulating at a time. And so and there had already been a lot of work done developing an influenza A H5N1 vaccine. This is accelerating. So I think we're going to be better prepared than we were with COVID. But that may help reduce the potential for a global pandemic.
Yeah, I kind of briefly want to touch on, so with COVID in and of itself, so there was an article this past January from the International Journal of Infectious Diseases that it estimated the COVID wild type virus, so that first kind of wave of COVID that we saw, had an overall case fatality rate globally of 3.6% with about 4.8% in North America. And one of the more concerning aspects of H5N1 in and of itself is it has a high mortality rate. Per the CDC, from 1997 through late April of this year, there have been a total of 909 sporadic human influenza A H5N1 cases that were reported worldwide. And this is from 23 different countries. Mm-hmm. Of those cases, 52% of them were fatal. So it's extremely high fatality rate. So with kind of regard to vaccines and how that could kind of help, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services actually are moving forward with a plan to produce 4.8 million doses of H5N1 flu vaccine just for pandemic preparedness. And I guess they've been in talks also just with Moderna and BioNTech, who did the first two COVID vaccines, just to develop an mRNA vaccine as well. So knowing that, I guess with regard to vaccines, yearly we have influenza vaccines that are presented to us to take, but a lot of times they're only at best about 40 to 60% effective. Can you kind of touch on why the efficacy can be so low for some of those vaccines?
Oh, that's a tough question. I think it's partly the trying to make a match between circulating strains of influenza A and B each year, and then also if the match, basically we use data from the Southern Hemisphere and say, all right, this is what we expect to see in the Northern Hemisphere. If the match isn't good, then the sort of cross protection may not be that great. That's one problem. The virus, as it starts to circulate in the respiratory season here, which is usually fall winter. May undergo some further drift, a little bit of modifications that make it, a little less responsive to the vaccine. And then I think the third is the sort of immunity engendered by the vaccine is good. I think it's really better. It's a little bit like some of the COVID vaccines. It's probably better, less good at preventing infection altogether and preventing transmission, but better at preventing severe disease and hospitalization. And those become very important indicators. Going back to your original comment, yeah, you're right. I mean, the data on mortality associated with H5N1 over the last 15 years or so are really scary. If we have a pandemic with a virus that kills 40 or 50% of people, we're in big trouble.
That might be the end game. I don't know.
But I think that, often what happens is the viruses evolve and they become... they become better fit for transmission, but less fit for killing off people.
I think we saw that in COVID, essentially, over the progression of COVID from that wild type to Delta, Omicron, and to where we are now. And even clinically watching that, the first year and a half to 2 years, it was, in the intensive care unit was really rough with COVID. And then we finally, once vaccines were introduced and even beyond that, started to see people who they would come in with COVID. And typically if you were intubated and you had COVID to begin with, you were not coming off the ventilator. And then we finally started seeing people, even people who were immunocompromised or older or had chronic diseases, and they could come in and be intubated, and then they'd get them off the intubation, or off the ventilator and out of the unit, which was amazing. We finally started to see that. But yeah, to your point, as typically viruses, for viruses to survive, just evolutionarily, they need their host to survive as well. So
exactly.
So they become less potent over time. Knowing that H5N1, these vaccines would be specifically targeted for that virus, though, whereas like you said, with the flu virus, we try to predict by seeing what happened in the Southern Hemisphere and try and, even mix for multiple different strains of the flu. With it being targeted for H5N1, do you think it would be more effective because it's tailored specifically for H5N1 than a few different viruses?
Yes, I think so. But as you mentioned in the very beginning, it looks like there's a very specific strain of the H5N1, the clade 2.3.4.4b, type, which is a bit complicated. Hopefully we'll have a simpler nomenclature. I think they tried to do that with SARS-CoV-2 with Greek letters, and then they sort of gave up when they got to Omicron. But I think that the genotype may become very important. And so this is going to be another situation where we're going to be needing to do regular sequencing and tracking, and then seeing as new genotypes become more dominant, are the vaccines really covering those adequately?
And so the Department of Health and Human Services, they kind of mentioned as well that there'd be certain triggers to start dispensing these vaccines. And essentially, it would just be an increase in human-to-human spread from the H5N1, or increase in animal-to-human spread, or cases that pop up that have no epidemiological links to any kind of dairy farms. Do you think that's kind of an appropriate response, that once we start to see these cases pop up a little bit more, to start dispensing these vaccines? And who do you think they would kind of prioritize? Because there's only a limited amount for right now. There's about 5 million. Do you think that would go to healthcare workers or dairy workers?
If one of those scenarios arose, I mean, I think it's going to partly depend on which of the scenarios it is. But I think it's going to need to be frontline workers. So healthcare workers for sure, but also people that are having, if it's coming from cattle to humans, then anybody who's having exposure to cattle. And especially veterinarians, but also, sort of anybody working the dairy industry or cattle industry. So I think it'll depend a little bit on sort of what the evolution is.
The CDC, over the last, this has kind of been something it's in the infectious disease world, been following for about 2 or 3 years now, because it slowly started progressing from avian fowl, then you saw it in some kind of water mammals, and then spreading, and now with cows, especially in the United States, it's starting to become more of a hot topic. And the CDC, they have a dashboard set up now, and it monitors wastewater for influenza A. It's not specific to H5N1 right now, but do you think by monitoring wastewater, similar to how they did with COVID, would help us kind of detect or be able to track a little bit better where and how these new infections are popping up? Or do you think there's lag time in that?
I think wastewater surveillance will prove to be very useful for this virus as well. I mean, it's been fantastic for SARS-CoV-2. I think that the trick is, or the challenge is going to be, we're going to need to look at human wastewater, but also wastewater coming from cattle farms or dairy farms, and trying to sort of find out if there's an outbreak there, and then perhaps, put up a wall, not a wall, but sort of a theoretical, preventive measures to try and prevent it from spreading outside of that, to contain it. I can't say, I think it's too early to say. A couple thoughts. One is, my hope is that they'll be able to develop better technology to assess for influenza H5N1 in the wastewater rather than just any influenza A virus. Second is that there will be more widespread tracking. Like in the Boston area for COVID, it was really all done through the Boston water system, and that just pools all the water from north and south of Boston. And I think it was a great barometer, and it's actually super fascinating to look at it and see how that's evolved over time. I actually think it's starting to fall into more of a seasonal fall-winter pattern for SARS-CoV-2, looking at this data. When there's beginning to be a rise, that was followed by more confirmed cases in the community or hospitalized cases. So I think it can be predictive, but again, I think it's a tool that we still need to know how to use better.
So I guess to kind of wrap up here, what kind of advice can you give our listeners with regard just to how to stay safe in everyday life, not just with influenza or respiratory illnesses, but just avoiding illness together from an infectious disease standpoint?
I think that we've learned a lot about transmission, especially respiratory viral pathogens, and I think some of it just basics is just, you know, good hand hygiene and good respiratory hygiene. And so if you have a, you know, sore throat, cough, runny nose, you need to think, you know, that you're probably infected with the virus. These days you can do a rapid test for COVID, at least many people can. If that's ruled out, then actually we had a fairly good number of pretty severe influenza cases this winter. And so influenza should be next on the list, although that should be dying off now. But I think of others around you, put a mask on. And then if you're older, you have a weakened immune system, if you have any risk factors, you know, if you're out in public, in a crowded place with poor ventilation, think about wearing a mask. Definitely, if there's any evidence of influenza, H5N1 taking off, but I'd say for, you know, more broadly for any circumstances. I mean, right now, COVID's come down in Boston, influenza's coming down. I think the risk is not that great right now. But you know, people need to be good towards others by basically trying, if they get sick, trying to limit potentially infecting others. And then people that are really at risk need to be cautious in public places.
Excellent. Thank you so much. I appreciate very much coming on. Hopefully you'll come back on again and discuss. There's a multitude of subjects we could talk about. It's, you know, extensive, and you've had such a, just reading your bio, I mean, you know, 20 plus years of experience in infectious diseases, and beyond that, just your other work in underdeveloped countries and just trying to help those populations as well, which is something here in the United States we often don't consider. We're very, very lucky to, or just to live in a system that has proper healthcare, but even beyond that, just clean drinking water and all these things that we take for granted. So I'd love it if you'd come back on at some point in time, just talk about your other initiatives that you're involved in. But thank you very much for taking the time, and enjoy your trip right now. Yeah, when you get back to Boston, let me know, or I can email you if you have any other ideas for shows that you think might be interesting or that our listeners would like to hear about, or even just anything you want to talk about. I'd really appreciate it.
Yeah, no, I'd be happy to do it. I mean, honestly, I think that we'll see how things go over the next few months, but dengue and or chikungunya would be good topics. I mean, dengue, the rates in South America and the Caribbean right now are higher than they've ever been. I mean, it's just, I'll send you a curve just from The Economist. It's just unbelievable. It's taken off like a rocket. So we're actually working on a commentary right now about the potential risk of introduction of dengue and potentially chikungunya, but especially dengue at the Paris Olympics, because the mosquitoes that can transmit dengue have been now found as far north as the Paris area. And last year, not in Paris, but in the greater Paris area, there were 3 patients with dengue with local transmission.
And is that a relatively new development? Like, typically you wouldn't see spread that far north.
No, right? But what's happened is there's one of the competent vectors for dengue has been gradually working its way up from it started in the Mediterranean. Now, after 10 or 12 years, it's worked its all the way up to the Paris area. And so the potential for introduction and spread is great in Spain, Portugal, France, Italy, Greece, even getting it a little bit into Switzerland and Germany.
Definitely. Yeah. I'll have to look into that. Yeah. Send me some information. I'll start to research it. That'd be great.
Yeah. Good.
All right. Okay. Excellent.
Andrew, nice to talk to you.
Thank you again. You too. Very. Have a great trip and safe travels.
Okay, good. All right.
Thank you.